National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
Questions in Charlotte. A group of Charlotte priests have asked the Vatican to judge their bishop's prohibition on altar rails and kneelers during communion. This week on Register Radio, we talked to Register Senior Editor Jonathan Liddle about the liturgical controversy surrounding Charlotte's Bishop Michael Martin. And then Indiana University QB Fernando Mendoza just won the national championship and the Heisman Trophy, but he gives the credit and the glory to God and never misses Mass on Sundays. We talked to Register staff writer Gigi Duncan. Hello, I'm Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register and co-host of Register Radio. Matthew Bunsen is out this week. According to reports confirmed by the Register, 31 priests, roughly a quarter of the priests in the Diocese of Charlotte, North Carolina, recently sent questions called dubia to the Vatican's Dicastery for Legislative Texts, along with a signed letter by the priests. The priest asked for formal clarification on a number of liturgical norms issued by Bishop Martin of Charlotte in a pastoral letter issued last month that banned the use of altar rails, kneelers, and prie-dieus for the reception of communion in public celebration. What is happening in Charlotte, and how does this new flashpoint in the so-called liturgy wars have wider implications for the church in the United States? Jonathan Liddle, Register Senior Editor, has been covering this story. He joins me now.
Good to be with you, Shannon.
Great. Jonathan, you've been following the developments in the Charlotte Diocese for much of the past year or so. First, give us a quick recap.
Yeah, absolutely. So this dubia is really just the latest chapter and kind of an ongoing saga in Charlotte. And it really centers around Bishop Martin's desire to kind of transform how the liturgy is celebrated in the diocese. So he's been there since May 2024, but things really kind of got controversial a year into his tenure when in May 2025, a letter was leaked that included his proposals for restricting the liturgy, elements of the liturgy in Charlotte, and not just the traditional Latin Mass. I want to make that point up front clear. Everything we're talking about during this segment is not about the traditional Latin Mass, meaning how the Mass was celebrated before Vatican II. It's about how the Mass is celebrated in most churches now, the Novus Ordo. And in that letter, for instance, Bishop Martin said that Latin could no longer be used in that. So some churches say the Agnus Dei, right, the Lamb of God prayer in Latin, that would be prohibited. The use of kneelers during Mass or altar rails built into the church would be prohibited. Even praying the St. Michael the Archangel prayer at the end of Mass was one of the proposed changes prohibiting it that was included in that leaked letter. Now, it was never enforced, but it definitely raised a lot of concerns about perhaps a kind of just very widespread and very sort of micromanaging approach to moderating the liturgy in its diocese. Of course, the traditional Latin Mass, which was very strong in Charlotte, was restricted to just one chapel 45 minutes outside of Charlotte, which was controversial as well. And then that, has brought us to this past December, when Bishop Martin did issue, in fact, liturgical norms prohibiting the use of built-in altar rails, the use of kneelers and prie-dieus in churches when people are receiving Holy Communion. So again, we're not talking about the traditional Latin Mass. We're talking about your typical Novus Ordo Mass celebrated at a parish where there might be an altar rail built in, or where the pastor of the church might have put out kneelers. So people who desire to kneel when receiving communion can do so easily. So Bishop Martin put a stop to that. It went into effect just this past week in Charlotte. And that's really what the dubia, these requests for clarification from the priests, are centering on, but also his leadership and authority to carry out some of these changes overall.
Yeah, so let's talk about the priests' questions. What exactly are they asking the Vatican to clarify?
Yeah, so as you noted, this is 31 priests from the Diocese of Charlotte, a pretty significant number, about a quarter of the priests in the diocese. Two-thirds of the signatories are pastors, which is also significant, right? These are the men who are leading parishes. And yeah, I mean, I think they're asking the question about whether the bishop has the authority to intervene and issue a norm prohibiting it, you know, for the instance, in the case of altar rails and prie-dieus. It is a right of the people of God, of the faithful, to receive communion kneeling if they so desire. There's no question about that. And so some parishes, right, they attempt to facilitate that by providing kneelers. If a lot of the people are kneeling to receive communion, there are kneelers there. Or, you know, there are altar rails built into the churches between the sanctuary and where people are sitting, as a natural place for that to happen. So one of the central questions is really asking, can a bishop, if there's a right for people to receive in this way, or altar rails, which are a traditional fixture in the way many churches, not just before Vatican II, but even new ones that have been built since were designed, does the bishop have that extra authority to step in and prohibit something that seems to be permitted by universal law, right? There's no prohibition at the top level of the church from the Vatican on something like receiving communion at an altar rail or using a kneeler. And so I think that there's really a request for clarity, clarification on what really is the role of a bishop in moderating the liturgy and the celebration of Mass in his diocese. What can he do and what can he not do?
Right. So interesting. So when we originally pursued this story, and we should give credit to the Pillar website, they broke the story about this dubia. They got a copy of the letter. And I think when we approached this story, we were primarily looking to see how unusual is it for this many priests of a diocese to take this formal canonical step. But in the course of your reporting, you discovered that there are differing opinions on some of these questions that they're asking, which seems sort of straightforward. You know, it would be for those of us who are not expert in canon law, I mean, it would seem like this would have been answered a long time ago. But there's differing opinions on if or how a Vatican response to these questions could have a wider impact on the governance of liturgy beyond Charlotte. So I think that surprised us, but can you summarize the arguments on both sides?
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, for any listeners out there, we're talking about Charlotte, a specific diocese in Western North Carolina. But the principle in question is whether a bishop can prohibit or ban or restrict a practice that the universal church, right, the Pope, like the highest levels of the church, has said is okay to do. Can a bishop issue a blanket ban in his diocese on that practice? So it's a principle that, if you think about it, applies in lots of other places too, right? We know of different dioceses in the U.S. where, for instance, the ad orientem posture, both the priest and the faithful facing the altar together during the Mass, has been restricted or prohibited by the local bishop. So you're right, Shane. I was really surprised. You know, I'm not a canonist myself, and I thought a lot of this would be just pretty straightforward, either a yes or a no. But, you know, different canonists will point to different aspects of canon law or different other documents from the Vatican to really try to settle that question of what a bishop can prohibit liturgically and what he can't. And yet I talked to two different canonists. I talked to one at CUA and one who's taught at the Angelicum. And basically the two different arguments are that, yes, there are big, one says, yes, there are big unanswered questions about a bishop's authority to regulate the liturgy, and that the Vatican's response to this dubia, the set of dubia from Charlotte, could have implications for the whole church. And on the other side of it, I was told, no, there aren't really open questions. Like, the bishop has basically supreme authority in his diocese to moderate the liturgy, from you know, how communion is received to the posture used during the liturgy, and that if a response from the Vatican does have any implications, it'll really be informal, right? If the Vatican, for instance, said Bishop Martin exercised his authority, he didn't consult enough or he didn't do something like that, that might make bishops in other places think twice before they push through similar kinds of changes. But it doesn't really rule out that they have the authority to make these kinds of prohibitions. So it's kind of, I mean, I don't know about you, Shannon, but I was just really surprised to hear two canonists. I asked them the same set of questions and they gave me just, you know, very conflicting, contrary answers. And it just goes to show that, you know, canon law, similarly to our law in the United States, right, is open to interpretation, and different people are going to take some instruction or some language in different directions. And that might require the Vatican itself to clarify, you know, what really are the laws of the church, in this case, governing what a bishop's authority is over the liturgy.
Right. So the dubia has been submitted to the Vatican. What happens next?
Well, there are a few options, right? So the Vatican really could choose this dicaster for legislative text not to answer the dubia at all, right? We've seen that before with the Vatican, especially on controversial issues. They don't weigh in. We could see them answer, you know, all of the questions asked or some of the questions asked, but there's no guarantee that they would publicize those responses. Another option, because it's very interesting, the dubia touch on liturgical issues, right? But they weren't submitted to the Dicastery for Divine Worship. They were submitted to the Dicastery for Legislative Text, right? Which is kind of the body responsible for clarifying things that have to do with canon law. So it's really a question of law and authority, and not strictly speaking, what's good liturgy and bad liturgy. But for right now, it's in the hands of the Dicastery for Legislative Text. And yeah, I mean, according to one of the canonists I talked to, it points to a huge unresolved question that could again have implications, you know, for dioceses across the United States. So it's something very interesting to watch. There's all kinds of nuances and details and canonical and liturgical nitty gritty in here as well. And I know a lot of people will be paying attention if there is in fact a response.
Yeah, not the least of that is the fact that Pope Leo is himself a canonist. So, you know, he's aware of these issues. So it'd be really interesting to see. Hopefully we'll hear what direction they're going to be going in. Meanwhile, you know, there's still a lot of unsettled things going on in the Diocese of Charlotte. So keep them in their prayers. Well, thanks, Jonathan. We're looking forward to your continuing coverage of all these different strands related to these great liturgical debates that are still playing out in our church. So thanks very much. You're listening to Register Radio on EWTN Radio. Next, we talk to Gigi Duncan about Catholic quarterback Fernando Mendoza. Stay tuned to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Shannon Mullen. Indiana University's football team went 16-0 this season and won the national championship of college football. IU QB Fernando Mendoza played a huge role in that first ever title for the university. He also won the Heisman Trophy. Mendoza is likely to be the number one pick in the upcoming NFL draft. And he is an active Catholic who never misses Mass on Sunday. Register staff writer Gigi Duncan is covering this fascinating story. Gigi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Gigi, let me start by introducing you as the Register's official Fernando Mendoza beat reporter. you're the logical choice, first, because I know you're a huge college football fan. But second, you know, Mendoza is another example of a Gen Zer and a young man, you know, embracing the Catholic faith and sharing it in a dynamic way, which is a trend you're following, you know, very closely. So It fits into that, you know, broader picture that we're seeing playing out in your generation, by the way. So, but for the few people out there who may not have heard of him yet, Who is Fernando Mendoza, and why are Catholics especially so enamored by him?
Yeah, so Fernando Mendoza was born in Boston, but moved to Miami. He grew up there, always dreamt of playing for the University of Miami Hurricanes. But then in high school, he was only a two-star quarterback recruit. He was often overlooked despite going to many different camps and sending tapes to major college programs. So he was actually declined even a walk-on spot with Miami. So he ended up going to the University of California, Berkeley, played there for a couple seasons, was able to lead that team to a bowl game before he ultimately transferred to Indiana. And he just has this really incredible story. Like I mentioned, he often felt overlooked. You know, people were just kind of passing him up within the college football realm. And then he comes to Indiana with this new coach, Kurt Cignetti, and they just totally rewrite Indiana's program completely. I mean, before 2023, they had the most losses in any Division I football program.
Like over more 700, right, Gigi?
Yeah. Yeah, they had the most losses. They'd never had a season with 10 or more wins. They really struggled. Even last year, they made the playoffs, but they kind of had an early exit to Notre Dame in the first round. So a lot of people were often discrediting them, saying, you know, they didn't belong. They had an easy schedule. They were kind of bound to repeat this pattern of losing and being irrelevant. But this season, I mean, with the help of Mendoza, the season just totally turned around. And I think what made him especially stand out for young Catholics was that he was so outspoken about his faith all throughout the season. You know, there's a lot of athletes who are Christian, and maybe they'll mention God once or twice. Maybe they'll do a Bible verse in sign language or write it on, you know, their wristband. But you have this athlete who not only gives all the glory to God, but then he goes into detail. He allows reporters to ask follow-up questions about his faith, you know, his kind of daily life and how he incorporates that into his games and training and practice and all of that.
Yeah, I think his personality also, as you said, you know, there's a lot of young athletes who speak in this way, and it is very inspiring and refreshing to hear. We cover that at the Register and EWTN because it is so refreshing. But his personality is really engaging. He's just so cheerful. You know, and then his relationship with his family is also a part of this story. Can you tell me more about his relationship, about his family, and particularly his relationship with his mom?
Yeah, so his mom was actually a tennis player at the University of Miami. So he comes from a very athletic family, but she was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2008, I believe. And now she's in a wheelchair, so she's kind of had to deal with this illness for almost the last two decades, really. And it's definitely played a big part in Fernando Mendoza's journey, it seems. He's always crediting, you know, her witness and her strength to his own strength, both on and off the field. You know, he seems to have a very close-knit family. You know, it's just one of the many things that I think has really intrigued people over this whole Indiana story. One thing is that his father, you know, throughout the games, he always remains seated, even in celebrations, you know, as an act kind of love and solidarity with his wife. So it's really sweet to see him kind of prioritize his family and his faith. You know, he mentioned he comes from a big Catholic family in several post-game interviews, and it seems to just be a really big driving factor in how he kind of conducts himself both on and off the field.
Yeah, Gigi, the Miami connections are fascinating, right? And, you know, the national championship game was played in Miami. You know, it's just, you can't make this up. Well, let's get into what he is. You know, his heroics on the field is a big part of his appeal. He played an amazing final game. He had this incredible pivotal play to kind of put Indiana over the top. But let's talk about what he's actually saying off the field that interests you.
Yeah, so there's been several moments that have definitely stood out for young Catholics like myself. I think one of the bigger things he was asked, I believe during the playoff run, about, you know, what's his hype music? What does he listen to kind of get ready for games? And he said, instead of, you know, picking a typical hype song, he actually prays. And he credited prayer as being a form of meditation that kind of helps him stay calm and cool and collected. There's been other instances where he's mentioned that he does a rosary every week. You know, he goes to mass. Sometimes he actually listens to mass ahead of his games. And I think another really great moment was after winning the Heisman Trophy, he actually brought it back to the St. Paul Catholic Center, you know, showed it with the priest there, who he really credited as having strong friendships and, you know, being a great source of mentorship for him. And, you know, when asked about it, he kind of elaborated further, saying, you know, how grateful he is for them, but that ultimately all the glory has to be given to the Lord in his life, both on and off the field. So, like I said, just kind of going into detail and, you know, moving past the initial, you know, thanking God in the sports moment, I think has just really captivated a lot of Catholics all around the country.
Gigi, what's the Dominican angle to this, his Catholic faith?
Yeah, so his priests at Indiana University are Dominicans, and they, you know, not only did he mention them kind of supporting them throughout the season with his faith, but they were actually able to go to each of the playoff games and then go on to the on-field celebrations afterwards. You know, he mentioned that they've been a great source of friendship and guidance with confession, doing masses, and just being able to talk with them. And yeah, it's been really fun to kind of see both the Dominican priests, specifically, I believe it's Father Patrick Hyde and Ben Keller, kind of tweeting about it, you know, sharing pictures on their social media, posing with Mendoza with the Heisman Trophy. I think, yeah, it's been really fun to follow along and to see how, you know, he kind of shows his faith both on and off the field.
Yeah, there's another story that you've written for the Register that's up at ncregister.com. Related to the National March for Life this week in Washington, D.C., you're going to be part of our coverage there. But there's another story that you wrote that does have a somewhat of a football and college football angle. Tell us about men, abortion, and healing the hidden struggle, your piece that you did for us this week.
Yeah, so I was able to speak with Niles Pickney, who formerly played at Clemson University, and then he played his graduate year at Minnesota. But he, during his time at Clemson, experienced an abortion with his girlfriend. And, you know, it was really touching kind of hearing his story, how he went through the typical male response saying, you know, I'll support you in whatever decision you make. It's your body, your choice. But then, you know, as an athlete and as a man, he really struggled with the grief of that abortion afterwards. And just kind of hearing his story about how, you know, he would often bottle up these emotions because as a man and as a football player, he was taught to be tough. You know, abortion doesn't affect men. Men aren't supposed to show emotions or any feelings. That it was really, you know, causing isolation. It was causing, you know, him to lash out, to be angry. And it was only when he first started confronting those feelings and acknowledging them that he was really able to start to heal. And, you know, years later through that, he was able to start work with Support After Abortion, which is an organization, you know, that specifically helps women and men, you know, deal with grief after abortion. They partner with pastors, with therapists, both secular and, you know, faith-based groups. But now he's the men's healing coordinator. So, you know, kind of similar to the Fernando Mendoza story, being full circle with Miami and then playing in the championship game there with Niles, it was really full circle of, you know, he really struggled with grief post-abortion, but now he's able to use his experience and his faith to help other men who are dealing with that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. In your reporting, how unusual is it for there to be outreach to men with their post-abortion struggles?
Yeah, it was really interesting to kind of learn a bit more and, you know, reflective of all the men I spoke with. I spoke with individuals from Men for Life and from Rachel's Vineyard. both they said and, you know, some of their participants have stated before that they didn't even know that there were resources specifically tailored for men who are dealing with abortion grief. So I think it's really important. It's an issue that a lot of people don't normally think about when it comes to men and dealing with the aftermath of abortions. And I think really highlighting some of these resources specifically tailored for men in all different walks of life. You know, they cater to young men who maybe just recently experienced an abortion, maybe older men who have kind of stayed silent on their experience and their feelings for maybe 20, 30 years. Men of faith, men, you know, who don't consider themselves religious. There's all these different resources out there that are able to help them. And I think it's really important to highlight that because, like they said, they didn't even realize that those resources existed specifically for men.
Yeah, I really encourage people to read that story. I'm so glad you did it, and I'm looking forward to your other coverage of the march. Well, that's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Thanks for joining us at Register Radio here on EWTN. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Matthew Bunsen, I'm Shannon Mullen. Please take care and God bless.